now let's hear all about Italy, the land where lemons grow, with Helena Ackley and Matthew Fort.
Oh.
There's probably water out there.
Water. I want orange juice.
Oh, of course there's water, look.
Oh. We're doubling up on the water. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Very nice to see a fullish house here. You can always move in from the back, you know. It's like church. Everybody sits at the back. No one comes to the pews in front. Anyway, we're here not to talk about those matters. We're here to talk about citrus fruit. And I don't know if any of you have read Helena's absolutely wonderful book, illuminating, almost as fragrant as the fruits themselves. And I thought we might just start off with discovering what she has brought along, what she got in the bag here, mysterious.
Well, Matthew, I went out this morning and did some shopping. And I brought an Amalfi lemon. Now, Amalfi lemons, as we both know, are supposedly not nearly as bitter as lemons are generally. So if you go to Amalfi and speak to a lemon farmer there, he'll tell you that if he's got a bit of a hangover, whack one of these through in two and just squeeze the juice into his mouth. If he's got a cold, hot water and lemon juice. If he's bruised himself, he'll rub half a lemon on the bruise. I mean, it's the cure for everything. The unfortunate thing is, if you...
How much did it cost?
Ah, no, I wasn't going to say the price. Oh, loads.
But just see, it might be a rather expensive way of curing a bruise. That's what I can say in this country. It's all right if you pluck it from the tree.
No, I was going to say, as somebody who hasn't grown up in Amalfi, you know, when you're offered a lemon salad, which is simply slices of lemon with olive oil, garlic and parsley and nothing else, you know... I have to admit, it's an endurance test.
So what else have you got there?
What else have I got? I've got a cedro, a citron, what we call a citron. Got some nods there, people who've seen these before. And this was actually the first kind of citrus fruit to reach Italy. Came in 70 AD, right down in the south to Calabria, with Jews who were fleeing after the Romans had knocked down their temple in Jerusalem for the second time, and the Jewish diaspora began to spread around the Mediterranean. And they brought this fruit with them because they use it in the celebration of Sukkot, the festival of tabernacles. And of course, that's another, I mean...
And to this day, do you get... Hasidic Jews going down to southern Italy in order to buy the cedro?
You get Lubavitcher Jews. It's just Lubavitchers. And the citron that grows in Calabria is the Diamante citron. And it's long and thin and ribbed. And when it's fully grown, it's like a puppy. I always think it's like a puppy. You know, it's about that long on your arm. But it's harvested for the Festival of Tabernacles in August, when it's just the right size to hold in your hand and take into the synagogue as part of the prayer cycle.
Well, interestingly, it wasn't just the citron that the Jews brought through with them. They also brought the techniques of raising geese and ducks for foie gras. But that's another story.
Oh, did they? There we are. I didn't know that.
Another story. Now, tell me... Why did you start hitting off, write a book about citrus fruits?
I often asked myself that, of course, because it did take a long time to write. It was meant, I think my contract was for a year, and it took 3 years in the end, 2.5, 3 years, because there were so many journeys involved. But it started a long, long time ago, because I... used to spend a lot of time in Italian gardens, writing about Italian gardens. And a lot of Renaissance and Baroque gardens in Italy have citrus collections. You know, those wonderful terracotta pots with ancient citrus trees. And I started to notice that these trees weren't just straightforward lemon trees or orange trees. If you look closely, some of them had two or three different kinds of fruit on the same tree. And I thought, that's, you know, there's something going on here. Some of them had fruits that were striped in different colours or looked like hands clasped together. And I started to investigate that, and I discovered they were originally parts of collections of curiosities, so early museums.
Would these trees have been 200 or 300 or several hundred years old?
They were, many of them were over 300 years old, yes, and had been in the same gardens, being looked after century after century.
It's extraordinary, the sort of survival of that. Oh, and what does that tell you about, I mean, Italy seems to, having read the book, which is miserable and utterly delightful, having travelled extensively through southern Italy and through Sicily, I learned so much, which I wish I had known at least 10 years ago. But what has made Italy that sort of a centre of citrus culture, if you like, do you think?
I think every Mediterranean country. I mean, as I said, the Jews brought the citron, and then the Arabs brought oranges and lemons in the 8th century. Mm-hmm. And it was the discovery that citrus could grow in a Mediterranean climate with a lot of effort, because they're very thirsty. So you need an irrigation system, and you need to be sort of horticulturally quite sophisticated. But I think once the Arabs brought those techniques to Italy, and the Normans just continued that in Sicily, talking about, and then it's business. Citrus is big business. Wherever citrus arrives, it's like a sort of golden blessing. You know, you make money out of citrus, and that's, I'm afraid, that's what starts it. But then it becomes part of cultural life.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Is that in a sense you can easily grow citrus fruits up to a certain point in Europe, and then north of that, although you do discover, I must say, them cropping up in almost extraordinary places like Liguria and the Lake Garda and so on.
I mean, Liguria, which is of course on the northwest coast, is surprisingly far north, but it has a microclimate which makes it possible to cultivate citrus outdoors. But on the whole, when you get north of Naples, you're having to follow this wonderful cycle, really, that you, at the end on the, I think it's St. Catherine's Day in November, St. Catherine of Siena's Day, that all the citrus trees have to be brought into the lemon house, the Limonaia. And then the other St. Catherine is Alexandria, possibly. Yeah. They all come out on her day in April. And that's an extraordinary thing, because they put the citrus trees in exactly the same position in the Limonaia every year and back in the same position in the garden to create as little trauma to the tree as possible. And this can go on hundreds and hundreds of years, that these pots have gone in and out into the same places.
Was one of the delights of doing these, I mean, partly doing the journeys and partly with the people involved. My experience was always that there was almost a personal relationship between the gardener and whatever they were growing. I mean, I first came across, I was telling you earlier, about the bergamot down at the southernmost point of Calabria. And a signor familiare, who was an elderly old gent who I first bumped into, he took me around his orchard. And it was like a man tending an old collection of rather errant nephews and nieces, sort of stroking them, talking to them personally. Mm. Did you find that with your...
Very, very much so. And something that I really enjoyed about being shown around what they always call a garden, actually. It's a citrus garden. And at a certain point, the inevitable would happen that the person you were talking to would get a penknife out of his pocket, and he'd cut. You can't just pull an orange off the tree. It's very tough. You have to cut the stem, otherwise it tears the peel. So he'd cut the orange off the tree. And then he'd slice it in half horizontally and throw the top half into the long grass and then take a sliver off the bottom half, because that's where all the sugars accumulate in an orange. Take a sliver off the bottom half and hand it to you on a knife. And for me, that was, it was the sort of guilt-free equivalent of somebody leaning over to light your cigarette. You know, it's just that moment of connection, pure pleasure.
Yeah. What was the most sort of surprising thing that you found on your, in your journey? What was the most unexpected? Because clearly you had some idea when you set off.
Yes, I didn't have any idea what a big story it was. And I imagined that I would be sort of in southern Italy and in gardens further north looking at citrus collections. I didn't know that I would be in Piedmont, right up in the north, at the Battle of Oranges, where people just pelt each other in the face with oranges for 4 days. And it's all the end of, beginning of Lent, the end of the carnival season. It was very surprising. I didn't know I'd be on Lake Garda, which, you know, is 46 degrees north, where lemon trees were cultivated and the fruit was exported to Russia. Long gone now, but that's in the past. But the buildings are still there. I imagined, as I said, I'd be in Rome and Florence looking at the Medici citrus collection. I suppose I imagined I would be in Amalfi, but I didn't know about Calabria. And actually, Matthew and I were talking about Calabria and how my Italian is very serviceable. And I found myself in Calabria completely unable to understand people talking to me in dialect. We've both had that experience. Just like trying to understand quite technical things about citrus cultivation. You see, I don't know what you're saying. You know.
Well, I must say, I have a technique of dealing with that. I just nod sagely and say, si, oh, yes. certo, yes. And laugh occasionally, and yes. I find that that gets me by.
But it doesn't give you anything to write down when you get home.
I read books like yours, which will tell me. But one of the things that I found absolutely fascinating, because frequently, one of the things whenever you go to Italy, you find baffling are the names given to things and how this grows here, but you wouldn't eat that over there, or was produced here, bits of pasta or vegetables, whatever it happens to be. Now, there seems to be a particular problem with citrus fruits, is that absolutely no one actually has a clear idea of how to categorise them and which one is really the son or daughter of which. Is that correct?
Well, there were only three kinds of citrus fruit right at the beginning. One of them was the citron, the cedro. The other one was the mandarin. And then that huge thing called a pomelo, you know, that looks like a huge grapefruit. Pomelo from Malaysia, mandarin from China. This chap comes from Assam, northern India. And most plants won't cross-pollinate and produce viable seed unless they're cross-pollinating with something of the same species. Citrus are just completely suggestible. They'll cross-pollinate with anything that's got citrus in its name. And this creates what taxonomists call taxonomic havoc, which I think is a great phrase, because they just go on, the family just goes on and on and on expanding, and all the things that we eat, you know, the things like lemons and oranges, they're just a product of cross-pollination. And so when you grow trees, another characteristic of citrus is that it can have sort of genetic changes. Things can happen if the wind changes direction or there's a lot of rain one year. It can mutate in one part of the tree and produce a fruit that's completely different to the rest of the tree.
This must make it an absolute nightmare. It's a nightmare. As professional growers.
But what it means is that areas, you know, somewhere like Liguria, for example, which has that microclimate, and they grow a fruit called the chinotto, which is a tiny little, do you know it? Tiny little bitter, what they use to make Campari bitter.
That's
in
right,
fact.
Yes.
Very, very bitter. And they grow that, and it's a unique variety of the Kinotto that only grows on a stretch of coast, you know, 40 miles either side of Savona. And it's the same with the citrons in northern Calabria. Every area has its own geographically defined variety of fruits. So industries then are created around these features.
Of course, the most particular one of that is the bergamot.
The bergamot.
A favourite.
Yes, we've agreed in the green room. We were talking about bergamot, and we agreed that eating bergamot, which is really the most valuable citrus fruit in the world because its essential oil is used for the perfume industry, but it's also locally has kind of culinary use, and it's like, well, Matthew said it's like eating perfume, and I think it's like eating incense. You know, it's so pungent.
Yes.
But in places like Reggio Calabria, right down in the south, all their pastries have bergamot cream and bergamot icing, pale, pale green or pale yellow, depending on the time of year that they're harvested. And it's a very distinctive, very interesting taste.
But it's also, it only grows in that very narrow band between the tip of southern Italy, tip of Calabria, and roughly Villa San Giovanni, which is...
Just goes around the tip. That's right.
Thanks, Lucy. Right.
Almost is inland too, doesn't it?
Yes.
I believe.
Yes, very narrow. Yeah.
But what I didn't notice in your book, which is a legend, which I think...
To the designer element of Paige Tiger now. And as you can see, I've got my template here. Over here on the right hand side.
Archbishop of Naples. Is that
I hadn't heard that.
Is that just a legend?
I hadn't heard that.
Because I did think it was probably, if it was so, it was one of the more enduring miracles of that part of the world.
I was thinking, Matthew, that, you know, we're at the destination show, so we've got a lot of people who are very interested in travel here.
There we go. Right, so that's page number one.
I suppose the thing that I would suggest as the most lovely journey is to pick one or two fruits and to go, you know, either to go now during harvest, because that's the lovely thing about citrus, just when everything's winding down here, it's all cranking up in Italy, because the main citrus harvests are from November to the end of March. And to go and, you know, to taste some of the things we've been talking about and to see the fruit on the trees, or to go to Sicily at the beginning of April when the citrus blossom is at its height. And, you know, you land in your plane at Catania Airport, and as they open the doors, you know, that scent just comes straight up the air, you know, up the aisle of the airplane, just hits you in the face. It's so powerful that after a bit you almost want to get away from it.
Well, it is, yeah. It's true, isn't it? It's, you could travel throughout Italy and Sicily, and indeed through the islands as well,
yes,
following the routes of various fruits and find changes. And because a recent trip I made through the Italian islands, I found two lemons, giant lemons, one on Procida in the Bay of Naples and the other on Capri in the Bay of Naples. And I found another citrus fruit on Sardinia called the Pompia, which only grows in a small area around a town called Sinagra. So the point about, you know, is that where travel and interest in food and gardens and fruit come together is when you is this through this sort of act of discovery.
Mm.
So when you were planning your trips, I mean, were these based over a number of years, or and were they carefully planned, or did you just hear of a story? Which
you know the answer, don't you, Matthew? I would. I was just going backwards and forwards all the time, and I was telling Matthew earlier that all the.
Yes, pretty much, yeah.
I mean,
you could leave the colours same.
My destinations were, I mean, I went to Candian factories, I went to laboratories where doctors were doing research on anthocyanins and, you know, all the medical implications of citrus fruit. I went to museums, I went to art galleries, I went to farms.
Panels down. So if you were concerned about your colleagues messing around with your logo, with your hex codes, if you had something you very specifically never wanted moved, you could lock that panel. You could
call. And it always said, you know, if you want to see this thing, you've got to be in a certain place on a certain day at this time. And when you get there, ring this number.
My colour changes on the panels now. I'm just going to do the icon changes. There we go. Selected both of those there. That makes life very easy. I'm going to make those icons green.
9 times out of 10, I didn't know which number I was using.
I think this page is lacking something, though. So I'm going to add a image panel.
You know, I had no idea who this contact was, and I would...
Drag and drop there. You know, there we go. I'm going to go back into content mode.
You know, sometimes jump.
Find myself an image and drop it.
And find myself in an extraordinary variety of different places. And after a year or so of this, I thought it's a bit like being on a citrus treasure hunt. You know, because I get all these clues and I just follow them, and it takes me all over Italy.
But isn't that the sort of the great thing about projects of this kind, is that food never arrives on your plate by accident. You know, behind this lies thousands of years of history about trade, conquest, travel, and botany as well. So
yeah.
It's a sort of a constant process of exploration and discovery.
It is, and it's also something that I thought about very much during that time was... our, as humans, our wonderful determination to eat even the inedible, you know, to find ways of making things that are fundamentally inedible edible. So
here we go.
In my bag, I've also got a couple of, I mean, let's pretend that these are chinotti. The chinotto is a fruit about this size, and I mentioned it before, it's so bitter that you really cannot eat it. It's got very rich quantities.
Activity button, and look at my page overview. So this is my,
you know, really, you should leave
eight pages. Right.
And I just think it's
on page four. I've left a space for a video file.
Campari. When he was
absolutely, yeah. One of the key things when you're designing an interactive document is to...
He was called, wasn't he? He came from Milan. Yeah. And part of
so we've left a nice big...
Campari is chinotto, but also the whole thing of candying. And just the process for candying a chinotto or a citron. You know, step number one, you soak it in brine for a year. I mean, that's determined, isn't it? You soak it for a year in salt water. You get it out, and you then have to soak it for a week in fresh water. So it's taken a year and a week now. And then you boil it
to the system
in a solution of sugar. And then you've got something that you can cut up into very tiny slices. And it's still, I mean, a candied... chinotto is an extraordinary thing because it's so bitter, it retains some of that bitterness. And so you put it into your mouth in one, and the outside is got the sugar, main sugar content, but then you bite through the skin and it's bitter. So there's this layers of taste.
Incidentally, they also use it for adding to Barolo. The Barolo Chianotto, which is a particular drink in Turin,
yes.
Which I think went out of favour for a number of years ago for obvious reasons.
Yes.
It was probably undrinkable,
yes.
But it's beginning to make a comeback, probably, I think, for medicinal purposes. I mean, what you describe there is an immensely complex, laborious process. Are we in danger of losing... I mean, one of the themes about your book is... how few of the traditional producers or the production methods actually still exist.
Mm. What happened in Italy was until the 90s, citrus production was protected.
The drag, the blue boxes, so we've got one for each
for
response.
Reason, I don't know why. That was
we've got limited. One for love it,
and so,
one for so-so.
Banal fruit.
And one for... not for me. So again, as you can see, it's simply
than the Italians.
Yes, you were very
and more on an industrial scale.
You're very
as well.
Sniffy about Valencia oranges.
I'm very sniffy about Valencia oranges and naval oranges, and I mean it's extraordinary how distinctive, for example, the Sicilian blood orange is. It's almost not an orange. It's so different from a Valencia orange.
And it also has particular health-giving qualities.
And it has. It's full of these things called anthocyanins, which are the red colouring, which is developed by cold. Actually, the coldness of the night, the contrast between the warm days and the cold nights. And the research is still ongoing as to all the brilliant things that anthocyanins do for us. It's super fruit.
Yeah. But that's what I find absolutely fascinating, that just the change of temperature of a few degrees produces almost a completely different eating experience, as I would see it.
I think it's the change of temperature. It's probably the volcanic soil as well.
Yes, well, I mean, the volcanic soil has a lot to answer for, both in Sicily and also around the islands. Why do the capers of Salina taste so particularly different from those of elsewhere? Because it's the volcanic soil.
Yes.
It's the salt in the air. It's the sunshine. Yes. It's whatever else.
But it does. I mean, that's that lovely thing, isn't it? That something that you eat comes with a real cargo of association and myth and tradition, and it cannot be bland.
Yeah, and this is why I, you know, it makes me fearful for the future, because as I say, you know, these products are not the ideas of economies of scale, vertical integration, and all the other nostrums of modern production are not consistent with the individual beauties of these particular products.
No. But the future for Italian citrus collection, I was very, very anxious not to write yet another heartbreaking book about loss, which seems to be, you know, what we think about a lot. And I believe it's to be true, and I was very relieved to come to the conclusion that the citrus industry in Italy will thrive in niche markets. And so those distinctive varieties that I was describing, you know, that only grow in certain places, are the areas of citrus cultivation that will continue and cannot be replaced. You know, people try to grow bergamot all over the world, but nowhere in the world will it be of the quality that it is in the very place that those two trees, the lemon and the bitter orange, cross-pollinated on the tip of Italy to create the bergamot.
I must say, one of the conclusions I came to the end of reading your book was that it's extraordinary how much delight we owe to pure chance, because all these fruits have really just arrived mysteriously, you know, for reasons that...
Yes.
For reasons that have, you know, no one can really rationalise.
No.
All you do is keep track of.
No.
I think we've probably talked enough, but I mean, to at least give a flavour of the land where lemons grow. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it. But are there any questions now for anybody? Anybody want to know more about the qualities?
Yeah.
Sorry, can we have a microphone here?
Okay, thank you. I have read the book, and I've given it to other people as well, and everybody agrees it's a tremendous book.
Thank you.
I was inspired to want to eat the inedible, and the Kinotto was the best example. And apart from getting the San Pellegrino version, which is...
the drink, which is
not really very good.
No.
I spent time asking people in Italy if they knew anywhere where I could get the candied peel Kinotto, and I couldn't find anybody who knew how to get it. Is there anywhere in England?
The company you need to look up is called Bezio, Besio, and they're based in Savona in Liguria, And I mean, you see it around. If you ever go to a garden fair, you know, you tend to see people selling it. But BESIO, it's easier if you can get to Italy. If you can get to Savona. In Savona, as you know, because you've read the book, in bars in Savona, they used to just have a big jar of these little chinotti. And when you had a coffee in the winter, they'd give you a chinotto as well in a little glass. And you'd knock back your espresso and then you knock back your chinotto. And it's all, you know, all one experience. And that's the place you can really get them now. Good luck. Because I really would like you to have that experience.
It sounds like an experience with slightly acquired taste.
Yeah. I'm disappointed with the responses of some people I very generously give my store of quinoa.
Or they reel back, clutching their brows.
Yeah.
Tasting the fruit did actually... reading the book actually did want you, make me want to eat some of the fruit that you wouldn't have thought about otherwise. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Another question? No more questions.
I've got a question. Can I chip in? As a foodie, it strikes me that you two might make rather excellent dinner party guests, although I might be slightly ashamed to present some of my dishes to you. What would you do with a citrus fruit? What would you serve? Because you mentioned that rather terrifying salad with the garlic. Mm. What would you think would be a really nice way to serve a citrus fruit?
Well, something that I mean to do at this time of year, every year, is what they used to do, I suppose, until the 17th, no, really the mid-late 18th century in Italy, which was to combine bitter orange juice with meat. And that's something that we don't do at all now. I mean, duck à l'orange, don't give me duck à l'orange. That's not what I'm talking about, okay? I'm talking about making a paste of sort of spices and the juice of what we call marmalade oranges and then basting meat with it and roasting it. Now, why don't I do it? I'm going to do it this year. But if somebody did that for me at a dinner party, I'd be really pleased.
Well, there is actually a fantastic Sicilian salad, which is fennel, oranges,
blood oranges. Yeah.
Incidentally, blood oranges, not blush oranges.
They're a fake.
Yeah, as their name would suggest.
Yeah.
And red onion and black olives, which is a particularly fine one. There's also, I was told, which I haven't actually tried yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Go on.
Are we all right?
Yeah.
Which was a salad I found on Procida, where they have these giant lemons, and you slice it up and you serve it with oil, chili, garlic, and mint, which is a sort of very Arab touch.
On the salad subject, something that sounds incredibly unlikely and is very delicious. If we were to should have brought a knife, shouldn't we? If we were to...
Anybody got a knife? Swiss Army penknife, anything?
If we were to cut this up, you would find that the pith was that thick and there's hardly any actual flesh inside. And there's a wonderful salad made from the pith of the citron, chopped up with parsley, black olives, olive oil. And it sounds unlikely, but is absolutely delicious.
But they also use the candied peel of the cedro. It's part of the candied peel mixture, which the Sicilians use in many, many pastries, and in particular in the cream that goes into cannolo, which is made from ricotta, sugar, and or honey, and bits of cedro peel, and if you're lucky, little bits of chocolate. And that makes this a uniquely overwhelming mouthful every time I've eaten it. You can taste so much sugar, I begin to hallucinate after a while.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, in Calabria, people halve a candied citron, and I told you they're that big, and fill it with ice cream.
Ah.
That's another one for you, Matthew.
Very big. Not quite as satisfactory, in my view, as having a brioche bun filled with ice cream. Mm. Sorry, this is nothing to do with Citroën, but is a particularly good way of eating ice cream, because you can then eat the ice cream, but also as it melts, it soaks into the bun that you're eating. So that last few mouthfuls are a delicious.
Are you going to go to Sicily for your holidays? Yeah. I mean.
Any other question? I've got to come up with other ideas of what to do with Citroën, but I think we better move on swiftly. Any other questions? No more questions?
Well,
I can't believe that anything's a subject so fascinating. Well, I'll ask a few questions in that case. How much, this goes back to the technical business of writing travel books, because in the end, it seems to me is that writing travel books is about as much about editing as it is about writing. Mm. How much material did you actually throw away to end up with this? Are there stories which you didn't put in?
There are always stories you don't put in, aren't there? There are always stories. And there are also stories about, you know, an awful lot goes wrong, doesn't it, when you're writing a travel book. And if you, I mean, one of the things that was a real kind of signature of this book was if you missed the season, if you missed the harvest for a fruit, you'd missed it for a year. And that was, you know, that was really quite desperate. And particularly when I was wanting to go, I heard about this harvest of citrons for the Lubavitcha Festival of Tabernacles. And I heard about it by chance. You know, I picked it up on the internet. I had no idea about it. And I thought I'd really like to go. And Calabria's, you know, almost, usually you know somebody who knows somebody everywhere, but I knew nobody who knew anyone in Calabria. And so I was reduced to phoning tourist information centres. And it didn't matter what telephone number I rang, it was a mobile, it was always the same man who answered. And he was always doing the same thing. He was always eating his lunch and watching cartoons on television. And anyway, he was very helpful. He said, yeah, when the Jews come, Signora, you know, I'll give you a ring, I'll let you know, that's fine. And I'd ring him in August every week or so, and it was like, it was as if we were bird watchers, you know. He said, no, I haven't seen Eddie, not at all. In the end, I rang a tourist information in a completely different part of Italy, and I got hold of a woman this time, and she said, oh, would you like to speak to the head of the consortium of citrons? And I said, yeah. And I got straight through to this guy. And he said, oh, they're leaving tomorrow. The harvest finished yesterday. And I thought, you know, that's it for a year. Yes. And so, there are things that happen. And
The frustrations of the travel writer.
And there's a lot of kind of being on your own and hanging about, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, I think that one of the things I noticed that I'm not really a true professional traveller, because prone to homesickness and, you know, longing for a pint of bitter and a packet of pork scratchings and, you know, and all right, the world is a beautiful place, but, yes. Oh, would you like to have someone to share it with?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, very, very much so. I think how to get through an evening on your own, you know, and yet another evening on your own. In fact, something that happened, probably the last thing we've got time for, but in Genoa, you know what I'm going to say, I was on my own on a winter evening in Genoa, and that microclimate that I mentioned meant it's very warm, even though it was probably this time of year. Lots of people sitting outside on the street having an evening drink. And so after a bit, I thought, you know, that's what I'll do. And it was just one of those really lucky things, because, of course, I ordered a Campari and orange. And the waiter, you know that thing when you're speaking a language, you know, however long you've spoken it, sometimes suddenly somebody will put that, like, face. And it's not just, it's just, I don't understand you, and actually you're a little bit disgusting, you know. And it really annoyed me. So I said, yeah, Campari and ice. That's what I always do. Lots of ice, lots of Campari. Fill it up with soda. I mean, fill it up with fresh orange juice. And he said, oh, signora, you mean a Garibaldi. And Garibaldi, of course, you know, Garibaldi set off from just down the coast from Genoa to free Sicily from the Spanish who'd been ruling it for 300 years. And all his volunteer soldiers wore red shirts. And so there was this bright orange drink that was named after Garibaldi and his soldiers. And it just made me think, oh, what an extraordinary kind of cultural thing citrus is, really, for Italians.
It's the great bringing together of botany, history, culture, people, society. And it's all in this really wonderful book. So read the book, make the journeys, go and visit, go and eat, keep the culture of citrus fruits alive.
And that's demand from your greengrocers. For a start, have a greengrocer. Make sure you've got a greengrocer. Get really friendly with them. Say, I want Italian citrus fruit. Blood oranges are in season from just after Christmas until the middle of April. Demand them. Say you want tarocchi. You don't want the rubbish they send here. Say you want the real thing, the good stuff. Because they need you, actually, the Italian citrus growers. They really need you.
There you are. A call to the barricades. Mm-hmm. Helena Attlee, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you.